The 20th year in the life of the United Nations is being observed throughout the world as International Cooperation Year, in the belief that greater awareness of the achievements of cooperation, rather than a preoccupation with conflict, will advance the cause of peace and human welfare. On this theme, United Nations Radio is presenting a series of special programs on the extent and nature of cooperation through international organizations. In this program, called A Climate for Justice, the speaker is Alexander Scorby.
Being, I regret to say, old enough to have more than merely childish memories of the 1930s, I'm sometimes haunted by an image of rather nervous people listening intently to shortwave radios. And with the image, I get an echo of what they heard from time to time.
Animati da volontà di collaborare e di pace.
Mussolini in one of his Roman balcony scenes, or Hitler on one of his swastikaed rostrums. Those too young to recall the climate of those times, to smell again the stench of evil that then enveloped the world, and to feel again the strong pulse of resistance that prevailed, may not realize how much the climate has changed in the last 20 years. This is not surprising, and I'm sure there are also many in older age groups who are now raising a cynical eyebrow at such an idea. All right, I agree. The last 20 years have been anything but pacific. There's plenty of evidence that the beast beneath the skin can still be easily provoked. It can still be man against man rather than man with man. But wait, the change is often beneath the surface. Often it is subtle, like the stealthy arrival of dawn. Nevertheless, it can be measured in many ways. Look back not just 20 years, but more than 40. In the covenant of the old League of Nations, there is what now must be considered a very curious omission. It contains no international guarantees of basic human rights. When it was being drafted, there were some proposals to include articles on racial equality and safeguards against religious persecution, but the opposition was determined, and the proposals, like unwanted film footage, ended up on the cutting room floor. With the UN Charter, it's a different story. It contains no less than 7 direct references to the question. Not only is there the reaffirmation of faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, and in the equal rights of men and women and of nations large and small, but methods of cooperative action to secure human rights are clearly defined. Discussion, study, recommendation, consultation, technical and advisory services, and, most significantly, binding conventions. If you take this emphasis on human dignity along with all the other provisions of the Charter, you discover something new in human history, a new dimension. In a speech on the development of human rights, which he gave a couple of years ago, Secretary General Thant made a point of this. Here's what he said.
What is surprising is not that provisions on human rights were included in the Charter, but that it took humanity so long to acknowledge the interconnection between human rights and its other aspirations. For what purpose is international peace and security to be maintained, if not to preserve the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? What is the use of economic development if it does not, in the words of the Charter, promote better standards of life in larger freedom?
In a very real sense, therefore, all the work of the UN and its agencies is directed towards making a universal reality of the dignity and worth of the human person. Most certainly, it is not designed to preserve the concept as a noble abstraction. The World Health Organization's fight to rid the world of malaria, for example, is not a philosophic exercise, nor is the Food and Agriculture Organization's Freedom from Hunger campaign, nor is UNESCO's assault on mass illiteracy. And another thing, in this pretty impressive mosaic of cooperative action, you have to reserve space for the political element. The human person has rights not only as an individual, but as a member of a community. And the UN's role in the great transition from colonialism to national sovereignty is a human rights story in itself. But I'm beginning to spread the net too widely. Let's resist that temptation and concentrate on some of the specific aspects of the matter and take, as a starting point, a day 17 years ago, December 10th, 1948. That day, in Paris, the UN General Assembly proclaimed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, perhaps the most influential document of our age. Admittedly, the declaration was proclaimed as a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations, but many see it as something more. Pope John XXIII was one. In his encyclical Pacem in Terris, he called it an important step on the path towards the juridical-political organization of the world community. And just in passing, I might add that the step was taken at the time without a dissenting vote. That's a fact not without significance when you remember that although the General Assembly was only about half its present size in 1948, it still represented divergent viewpoints on almost anything you care to think of. However, the crucial question is, what's been done since 48 to achieve the common standard? In the same speech from which we heard a bit just now, U Thant said,
"It is necessary to give legal recognition to human rights, to provide procedures and remedies for their protection, and to build by education and persuasion a climate of public opinion to sustain the enjoyment of those rights. Yet human rights cannot be secure without there being a determination, or if you prefer, a universal conscience on the part of peoples to uphold each other's rights in full understanding of the just demands of the individual, the community, the state, and the international order."
The techniques evolved in international organizations to do all this fall broadly into two groups, which could be called the legislative and the operational. The first, of course, is the one in which the various conventions are carefully and patiently drafted and adopted by the Assembly to become legally binding on governments once they have been ratified. There is, for instance, the historic Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, that hideous but not unknown practice of obliterating whole ethnic, cultural, or religious groups. There are conventions on slavery, the political rights of women, and on the status of refugees and stateless persons. Agencies like the International Labour Organization and UNESCO have adopted conventions on the abolition of forced labour and on discrimination in employment and education. But I don't want to bewilder you by listing everything and detailing just who has ratified what and where each convention stands at the moment. The striking thing, in my mind, is that this work goes relentlessly on, despite all the difficulties and complexities. It is one of the clearest indicators of the changing climate. So, too, is the work on the operational side. Let me give just a few examples. For some years now, governments have been reporting to the UN periodically on the progress being made in human rights in their countries. They report, too, on the difficulties they encounter. And out of it all grows an invaluable fund of common experience. Then there are the global studies on various forms of discrimination in education, political rights, religion, and, to add just one more, the right of everyone to be free from arbitrary arrest, detention, and exile. By cooperating in this, governments have made it possible for these studies to be veritable guidebooks for remedial action. And then there are the human rights seminars which the UN organizes in various parts of the world, generally attended by high-ranking public officials or important people whose work is directly related to the subject of the seminar. These meetings get very close to the heart of the matter. There was one, I remember, held in Australia 2 or 3 years ago, which dealt with the role of the police in the promotion and protection of human rights. How close can you get? The most recent seminar was held in Yugoslavia in June this year. It was a bit different from earlier meetings because it was organized on a worldwide and not simply a regional basis. 25 countries from all geographic areas attended to discuss human rights problems that can arise when several differing groups of people live in the same country, the multinational society. The agenda was concerned with matters that can be delicately personal. The right of groups in such a society, for example, to use their own language in everyday life and in courts of law. Their right of association. Their right to have their own schools. Their right to preserve and develop their own traditions and characteristics. When you consider how many multinational societies there are in the world, it's not difficult to appreciate the value of such a seminar. But I'm beginning to wonder if perhaps I'm not being too optimistic, if I'm not overpainting a still pretty somber picture with rather rosy hues. After all, the struggle for human rights is by no means over. And in their role in the struggle, international organizations face some special problems. U Thant noted one of the biggest when he said,
"Because human rights largely concern the relationship between the state and its citizens, the United Nations has had to, and will have to continue to, contend with the claims of domestic jurisdiction of states."
I guess the most conspicuous case in point here is a word which has come to mean the harshest and most complete form of racial discrimination, apartheid. For well over a decade, the UN, in the General Assembly, in the Security Council, and in special committees, has been exerting mounting pressure on the government of South Africa to abandon its racial policies. There have been petitioners, like the South African singer Miriam Makeba.
"In South Africa, our people, men and women, have asked for decades for their basic human rights. They have begged, they have petitioned, they have filled the jails in passive resistance movements. They have faced banishments, jails, and even death."
And there have been speeches and resolutions of condemnation.
"South Africa, by her intransigence and callous indifference to the pleas of the millions of Africans and other non-Europeans for fair and humane treatment, has isolated herself. It has been outlawed morally."
"Recently, most of us have felt that if persuasion was not sufficient to induce the South African government to change its policy, other means would have to be resorted to.
Universally condemned, this policy is doomed to fail in this day and age. Yet the government of South Africa stubbornly clings to it, and to make matters..."
Through it all, South Africa has consistently argued that its critics don't really understand what apartheid is, and that in any case it is strictly a domestic matter in which legally the UN has absolutely no authority. Now, I'm afraid I haven't the time, and this particular program is probably not the place to analyze the politico-legal aspects of this question. But I must draw one conclusion from it, and from all the other areas of international interest in the promotion and protection of all human rights. The fact that world opinion has been and continues to be unanimously mobilized in opposition to such outmoded phenomena as apartheid is a force for human unity that all the manifestations of disunity cannot forever withstand. Conflicts and injustices will continue to erupt like festering boils, but with magnificent determination, mankind, cooperating, can and will change the present climate to one of justice.
You have just heard Alexander Scorby in one of a series of special programs from UN Radio, produced for 1965, International Cooperation Year.